Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Tens of thousands of Syrians flee their homes. Tens of thousands of Syrians fled their homes in Aleppo Friday, headed toward Turkey as Russia intensified its aerial bombardment in northern Syria against rebel groups trying to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad. A charity, the Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation, said 50,000 refugees had arrived at the Syrian-Turkish border, although Ankara closed its crossing point and it was not clear if any would be allowed to enter. The charity said it is setting up tent camps in Syria near the border to provide temporary shelter. Turkey, which has already taken in more than 2.5 million Syrians since the Syrian civil war began nearly 5 years ago, said that thousands more are currently on their way to the border. And speaking of Russia, the first exhibition for foreigners, which opened in Moscow Friday, comes at an awkward time and place. In the same hall where President Vladimir Putin has his annual briefings and has recently levied much criticism at the West, rows of booths were set up for businesses catering to mainly Western foreigners. Russia's shrinking economy and tensions within the West had led hundreds of thousands of foreigners to leave the country for better opportunities. Russia's economy shrank by 3.7% last year on low oil prices and Western sanctions, and is expected to contract another 1% this year. The Islamic extremist group Al-Shabaab has taken control of the southern Somali town of Marka after African Union forces withdrew. One resident said the insurgent fighters carrying weapons hoisted Al-Shabaab's flag on the coastal town's police station and administrative headquarters. The Al-Shabaab takeover came a day after the Somali army and police stationed there left Marka, which is 70 kilometers south of the capital of Mogadishu. This is VOA News. Pakistan is hosting a new round of four-party discussions to help advance the Afghanistan's government's hope for peace talks with the Taliban. While all sides hope for progress in Saturday's meeting in Islamabad, Taliban insurgents have not yet signaled whether they will cease hostilities and join the process. VOA's Ayaz Ghul reports from the Pakistani capital.
The so-called Quadrilateral Coordination Group, or QCG, is made up of senior Afghan, Pakistani, American, and Chinese diplomats. They are reconvening in Islamabad for their third meeting. The diplomats are trying to prepare a roadmap for a sustainable and productive peace process and studying what to do about Taliban factions that oppose the talks and refuse to end hostilities. The Afghan Foreign Ministry spokesman Ahmad Shakib Mustaghani says he expects a roadmap for peace negotiations with the Taliban will be finalized at Islamabad meeting. Critics like Ahmad Rashid remain skeptical about the chances for progress.
The public is totally unaware of what is going on. What is this four-nation grouping that is talking about the Taliban?
Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's attempts to conduct peace talks with the Taliban could not move beyond a preliminary round last July after it became known the insurgent group's longtime leader, Mullah Omar, had been dead for 2 years, a revelation that disrupted political unity within the Taliban. The World Health Organization is advising officials not to accept blood donations from people who recently returned from countries affected by the Zika virus. The mosquito-borne virus is most prevalent in Latin America, particularly Brazil, and poses its greatest danger to pregnant women. Gérard Jones, a professor of economics at London's Lancaster University, says Brazil will also have to consider the economic impact resulting from the virus.
Now, in Brazil, tourism accounts for around about 10% of GDP. So this could amount to as much as 2% of GDP in terms of the hit that Brazil faces. In terms of dollars, that's getting on for $50 billion, which is a significant hit for an economy that is currently struggling.
The virus was discovered in Uganda's Zika forest in 1947, but scientists say it's never been a major problem on the continent. There's speculation that Zika in the Americas may be a different strain, but further study is needed to confirm that. A former U.S. pharmaceutical business executive has angered lawmakers by refusing to explain why he raised the price of a life-saving pill 5,000%. Martin Shkreli received a subpoena to appear before the hearing after his former company, Turing Pharmaceuticals, raised the price of Daraprim from $13.50 to $750 a pill. Joe Palca in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwean Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa on Friday dismissed recent calls by U.S. Senator for the African country to implement more reforms as a condition for new international lending. The request came from Senator Bob Corker, chairman of the U.S. Senate Foreign Affairs Committee.
That's Sebastian Monfu reporting from Harare. Details coming up.
Also, food shortages prompt Zimbabwe's president to declare a state of disaster, and Brazil sends Zika virus samples to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Guinea, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN mission in Mali says UN and Malian forces have retaken a police base in Timbuktu that was briefly seized by unknown assailants this morning. Mission spokesman Olivier Saldado said fighting at the site has ended and that security forces are searching the area for explosive devices. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. Northern Mali has been racked with violence in recent years, including insurgencies by Islamist militant groups and ethnic Tuareg militias. The UN established its peacekeeping force in Mali in 2013.
The Associated Press says ongoing drought has prompted Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe to declare a state of disaster. The announcement is likely aimed at accelerating food aid to the country, once known as a regional food basket. The drought is blamed on the El Nino weather phenomenon that is hitting parts of Africa, including the south. Besides Zimbabwe, South Africa, Malawi, and Zambia are experiencing crop failures and food shortages. The UN World Food Programme says the emergency has left about a quarter of the country's 13 million people in need of food assistance. So far, President Mugabe has blamed the situation on climate change and also on international sanctions. However, critics blame his land reform policies, which evicted many productive white farmers.
Zimbabwean Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa today dismissed recent calls by a U.S. senator for the country to implement more reforms as a condition for new international lending. The request came from Senator Bob Corker, chairman of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
Last week, Senator Bob Corker asked that the U.S. government's representatives at institutions like the World Bank, IMF, and African Development Bank block fresh funding to Zimbabwe until it shows progress on the rule of law and human rights. Corker made the request in a letter to U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. Finance Minister Chinamasa said Senator Corker had no idea of what was really taking place in Zimbabwe.
So he needs to be educated on a wide range of issues that affect Zimbabwe. And he should not be swayed by the distorted information that he receives about our country. It will be quite helpful for the senator to engage those who have been engaging us, the IMF, the World Bank, and African Development Bank. But we are very surprised, though, that Senator Bob Corker should take this issue.
Earlier this week, the finance minister said he would engage new U.S. Ambassador Harry Thomas Jr. once he is accredited, so that the Obama administration would have a better understanding of President Robert Mugabe's government. Senator Corker later said current law requires the Zimbabwean president to make a number of certifications that include restoring the rule of law and having satisfactory electoral conditions. These were among issues Corker said needed to be addressed before U.S. representatives to the lending institutions vote for Zimbabwe to resume receiving international funding. He said any new lending without reforms could significantly alter Zimbabwe's political dynamics and help entrench, quote, the very same individuals responsible for the country's economic collapse and gross human rights violations, unquote. According to Coker's letter, Zimbabwe owes $1.9 billion to the World Bank, IMF, and AFDB. All have stopped lending to the Southern African nation. Over the past months, Zimbabwe has been asking them to reschedule debt repayment while allowing it to access fresh funding. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A British photojournalist who was detained by Burundian authorities last month is speaking out about his arrest. The French news agency quotes Phil Moore as saying his arrest offers a disturbing insight into the intimidation and oppression that media face in Burundi. Moore was arrested along with journalist Jean-Philippe Remé. Security forces accused them of being in the company of armed men. Moore calls the allegation completely false. He says their actions questions the veracity of their assertions on much more grave issues. He adds that the incident sends a worrying message to what is already a heavily depleted media space in Burundi. Moore, who frequently works for AFP, and Remé, Africa bureau chief for French daily Le Monde, were freed after 24 hours.
The Associated Press says Brazil is sending samples of the Zika virus to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That follows criticism that Brazil had refused to share data about the disease with other countries. Zika first appeared in Brazil last year, but is now reported in 30 countries. While it's usually transmitted by a mosquito bite, it may also be transmitted through sex and blood transfusions. It's linked to thousands of babies having birth defects, but exactly why and how that happens is still not clear. The affected infants have abnormally small heads. As the Zika virus spreads through the Americas, the economic impact is being calculated. Brazil could be hard hit as it prepares for the Summer Olympics. Reuters quotes economists as saying the Olympics could be worth up to $25 billion to Brazil's economy. However, the epidemic could affect tourism and the money it brings.
The Zika epidemic is not restricted to the Americas. The AP reports the small South Pacific island of Tonga has 5 confirmed cases and 265 suspected cases. Some researchers think the strain of Zika is spreading through the Americas may have come from Asia rather than Africa. The virus was first discovered in Uganda's Zika forest in 1947. However, researchers say the disease has never been a major problem on the continent. The World Health Organization has declared Zika a global health emergency. Also, the USA Today newspaper reports the British Fertility Society has released recommendations on Zika. It says people who have traveled to Zika outbreak areas should not try to conceive naturally, donate sperm or eggs, or undergo fertility treatments for 28 days. It says the Zika virus is believed to stay in the blood for less than 28 days after a person is bitten.
The Zika virus rarely causes problems for the people who get it, but it seems to be having a devastating impact on babies whose mothers are infected with Zika. Since the Zika virus erupted in Brazil last May, more than 4,000 babies are suspected of having microcephaly, an abnormally small head. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
The link between Zika and microcephaly has not been scientifically proven, but the World Health Organization says until there's a better explanation, the Zika virus is the cause. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says microcephaly is unusual, But having this condition does not always mean that the baby suffers from other defects, like problems with speech, vision, hearing, movement, and intellect. Dr. Edward McCabe is the medical director at the March of Dimes.
10 to 15% of American babies with microcephaly are completely normal.
In a Skype interview, McCabe said the pictures of the babies born in Brazil seem to be severe cases.
The key thing is the baby needs to be evaluated. Doing an ultrasound of the brain, doing an MRI of the head. But the important thing is to follow the baby clinically. And it doesn't hurt to have early intervention if a baby's going to develop normally. So it's important to bring all of the assets that are available in modern medicine to bear to help get the baby the best possible outcome.
That might include physical or speech therapy. McCabe also says not every baby will have the same outcome.
Our knowledge of microcephaly and babies with microcephaly prior to the Zika virus association is that there is a spectrum that stretches from normal to even high intelligence through the spectrum in terms of developmental delay.
Until more is known about this virus, doctors are telling pregnant women and those who may become pregnant in Latin America and the Caribbean to wear long-sleeved shirts, long pants, a hat, and to use an insect repellent with DEET on any uncovered skin. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says respecting women's human rights and granting them access to reproductive health services are essentially in the fight against the Zika virus, which is thought to be linked to an upsurge of birth defects in Latin America. Lisa Schlein reports from the High Commissioner's office in Geneva.
Scientists are trying to determine if there is a definitive link between an outbreak of Zika virus in Brazil and more than 4,500 suspected cases of microcephaly, which causes babies to be born with abnormally small heads and brains. Evidence for such a link is strong enough that a number of countries in Latin America are running scared and are making tough demands upon women. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein, notes that some governments are asking women to delay getting pregnant, but are not providing them with a means to control or prevent an unwanted pregnancy. The High Commissioner's spokeswoman, Cecile Puy, says women and girls face an extremely difficult situation in Zika-affected countries that have restrictive laws governing women's reproductive rights.
In situations where sexual violence is rampant and sexual and reproductive health services are criminalized or simply unavailable, efforts to halt this crisis will not be enhanced by placing the focus on advising women or girls not to become pregnant.
Puy says upholding human rights are essential to an effective public health response. She says governments must ensure that women, men, and adolescents have access to comprehensive and affordable sexual and reproductive health services. She tells VOA that El Salvador is a country where women experience a great deal of sexual violence, yet have no way to legally protect themselves from getting pregnant or terminating an unwanted pregnancy.
Indeed that abortion is criminalized in all instances, and that's why we are asking those governments to go back and change those laws, because how can they ask for this woman not to become pregnant but also not offer them first information that is available but also possibility to stop their pregnancies if they wish so.
Puy says comprehensive reproductive health services include contraception, maternal health care, and safe abortion services to the full extent of the law. She says these health services must be delivered with a woman's fully informed consent, be non-discriminatory, and respectful of her rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhaib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Malian forces have retaken a police base in Timbuktu that was briefly seized by unknown assailants this morning. Food shortages prompt Zimbabwe's president to declare a state of disaster. And Brazil sends Zika virus samples to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The UNHCR is expressing concern over the conditions of refugees and migrants who are now in France, particularly children who are enduring the cold winter months there. Some 4,000 refugees and migrants are currently reported to be living in dire conditions in Calais and almost 2,500 in Dunkerque. Unaccompanied and separated children are the most vulnerable and have no protection from winter conditions. The UNHCR says it would welcome the establishment of additional emergency reception places for children to provide them with protection needs. I spoke with William Splendor, spokesperson for the UNHCR, about the conditions of the migrants and refugees in what is called the jungle.
Well, this is a makeshift camp that has been created by refugees and migrants who are attempting to cross the channel into the United Kingdom from northern France. And they are camping out in the open in very unsanitary and frankly appalling conditions with no access to running water or toilets or latrines. And among them, there are men, women and children from different countries. Some of them are fleeing war and persecution, and they are in need of protection. And these conditions, which are already pretty grim, are being aggravated by the winter with rains and low temperatures in that area.
Also, you all are very concerned, particularly with children and those who are unaccompanied. So what kind of problems are those children experiencing?
Well, apart from the kind of conditions in which they live, many of these children are traveling by themselves. They have either lost their parents or become separated from them, and they are arriving in this makeshift camps. They are in dire need of protection. They are extremely vulnerable. They can very easily fall prey to all sorts of exploitation. That's why we are sounding the alarm at this situation and calling on the authorities to do much more for these children.
What measures has France already taken to provide emergency assistance to the migrants and refugees?
France has taken considerable action to improve the situation. There is a center in Calais where some of these people have been accommodated, and they have also voluntarily transferred a number of people to other locations in France where they are being provided with accommodation. And we believe this is very important, but it's not enough. More needs to be done to provide also information to these refugees and migrants about their options, particularly the possibility of applying for asylum in France. Some of them want to go to the United Kingdom because they have relatives there and they want to join them.
Where are most of the migrants and refugees coming from?
Well, many of those migrants and refugees in Calais are coming from countries at war, such as Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, South Sudan, also countries that experience human rights violations. And all of them are refugees. We believe that a large proportion of them could qualify for refugee status if they applied for asylum in France. The problem is that they do not want to do that because they want to go to the United Kingdom, either because they have family members there or because they believe that they will have better economic opportunities in Britain. And part of the strategy of UNHCR is to give them information about the possibility of applying for asylum in France and to encourage them to do so, because we think that at least for many of them, the solution could be for them to apply for asylum in France.
Are there any problems amongst them themselves because they're all coming from different countries, different cultures, and now they've all converged together in one place and not in a good situation? So is that in itself causing a problem?
There have been in the past tensions between some of the communities, and there have been even fights, quite violent ones, between different communities there. Terrible conditions in which people are living obviously contribute to this. At the moment, we think that the situation is calm. The authorities have increased their presence there to try to maintain law and order, so that doesn't seem to be an issue at the moment, but the terrible conditions in which people live are the main problem, particularly with the onset of winter and the cold.
William Spindler is a spokesperson for the UNHCR. He spoke with us from Geneva. In related news, the International Organization for Migration says nearly 74,700 migrants and refugees have arrived in Italy and Greece this year via the Mediterranean. The vast majority arrived in Greece. Some 374 people have died this year making the journey.
Nearly 3 months after the November terrorist attacks in Paris, and after weeks of debates and protests, French lawmakers began today to examine legislation to beef up security laws. It includes proposals to amend the country's constitution. Two of the most controversial measures are writing the state of emergency into the constitution and removing French nationality status from convicted terrorists and others who threaten the nation's interests. In a National Assembly address today, Prime Minister Manuel Valls argued in favor of measures, noting the two major terrorist attacks in Paris last year killed nearly 150 people. Enacted the night of the November 13th attacks, France's state of emergency has already been extended once. It is set to expire on February 26th. Experts expect it will be extended. Among other things, the emergency powers allow French police to carry out raids and put people under house arrest without prior authorization by a judge.
The Islamic extremist group Al-Shabaab has taken control of the southern Somali town of Marka. Residents there reported today AU forces after they withdrew. One resident said the insurgent fighters carrying weapons hoisted Al-Shabaab's flag on the coastal town's police station and administrative headquarters. The Al-Shabaab takeover came a day after the Somali army and police station there left Marka, which is 70 kilometers south of the capital, Mogadishu. There was no immediate comment from AU officials.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Malian forces have retaken a police base in Timbuktu that was briefly seized by unknown assailants this morning. Food shortages prompt Zimbabwe's president to declare a state of disaster. And Brazil is sending samples of the Zika virus to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for testing. Coming up, we'll have music from Guinea, and in our feature segment, a music festival held in Bamako to help restore Mali's role as a culture powerhouse. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy, happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy, happy Friday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand it's a super sporting weekend.
That's a good way to put it, Kim. The 50th Super Bowl of American-style professional football will kick off Sunday in Santa Clara, California, just south of San Francisco. The big game features the Carolina Panthers against the Denver Broncos. At stake is the Vince Lombardi Trophy, named after the late great coach who led the Green Bay Packers to the first two Super Bowl titles in 1967 and 1968. Dan Friedel is covering the Super Bowl for Voice of America's Learning English, and Dan joins us now in the studio. Dan, welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Hi, Sunny. Thanks for having me.
Dan, the Super Bowl features two star quarterbacks at different stages of their career, 26-year-old Cam Newton of the Carolina Panthers and 39-year-old Peyton Manning of the Denver Broncos. What do they each have to prove in this game?
Well, Peyton Manning has to prove that he can still play football. It's as simple as that. He's had the most trying season of his career. Manning is a player who's been the standard bearer for the quarterback position for almost the last 20 years. He's set dozens of records in the NFL for things like touchdown passes and yards, and he's been one of the most consistent players in that position of all time and most productive. But he missed some time a few years ago with a serious neck injury that took an entire season for him to come back from. A lot of people thought his career might be over at that point, but Denver took a chance on him, and Denver thought that their team was good enough to make it to the Super Bowl with a primetime quarterback, and they have made it to the Super Bowl twice with Peyton Manning. The first time they made it to the Super Bowl, they played the Seattle Seahawks and lost in a blowout game. And Manning was really disappointed about how that game went. Now, Manning has had a tough season. He's missed a lot of time due to injuries. He had a foot injury, and a young quarterback came in and took his place and did pretty well. Manning came back at the end of the season and has done surprisingly well in the playoffs, helping the Broncos beat the New England Patriots to get into the Super Bowl. On the other side, we have Cam Newton, who is this energetic, young quarterback.
Powerful quarterback.
He's the same size as some of the defensive players, the defensive ends and linebackers. He's about 6'5", almost 240 pounds. So people who know that in meters, he's almost 2 meters tall. And he plays the quarterback position in this exuberant way. He runs for touchdowns. He throws long passes. And he loves to celebrate. And his exuberant celebrations, his go-to move is this dance move called the dab. His exuberant celebrations have rubbed some people the wrong way. So it'll be interesting to see what he does if and when he scores a touchdown in the Super Bowl.
Dan, speaking of celebrations, the Super Bowl in recent years always kind of celebrates the game with a big halftime show. Who are the musical performers for this Super Bowl?
So everybody watches the Super Bowl for different reasons. They watch for the game, what happens on the field. They watch for the commercials during the timeouts, and they watch for the halftime show. you know, famous performers like Michael Jackson have been in the halftime show before. This year, it's the British band Coldplay. They're the headliners, and they'll be joined by everybody's favorite singer, Beyonce. So it should be an exciting show.
That should be a great show. Now, in terms of the Super Bowl itself, Dan, and in particular, the overseas viewers outside the United States, are they tuning in more for the spectacle of the game, surrounding the game, or for the game itself?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are 30-plus teams, right? The NFL whittles it down to two teams in the end, so people watch the game not necessarily to see their favorite team playing, and they have to find a way to get into the spectacle beyond just what's happening on the field, whether the team has a third and long and they complete a pass that gets them a first down. So I think it's about a 50-50 mix between people who watch the game, who are dedicated football fans, and people who watch the game like it's just a big party.
Some of those fans will be tuning in to watch those commercials that you mentioned. What does a typical commercial during the Super Bowl for the advertiser, what do they have to pay the National Football League to air their commercial?
So they actually don't have to pay the National Football League, right? They have to pay the company that's broadcasting the game.
Okay.
The company that's broadcasting the game pays the league for the chance to broadcast the game. The Super Bowl gets over 100 million viewers in the United States each year. The price for 30 seconds of airtime is around $5 million.
Wow.
And it's worth it because so many eyeballs are glued to the screen. Some of the big advertisers in history have been Budweiser and a lot of the car companies. Some of the internet companies in the first part of the 2000s during the dot-com boom spent a lot of money to get ads on the Super Bowl, and then the companies failed within about a year. So that's always kind of funny.
All right, Dan, I'm going to ask you to stick your neck out a bit. Who do you like on Sunday, the Panthers or the Broncos?
So first off, I want to remind all of our listeners to check out some of the articles that will be going up this weekend at learningenglish.voanews.com. That's the Learning English website here at Voice of America. If you're a Facebook fan, you can find us by typing in VOA Learning English and looking for us on Facebook. So my pick is the Carolina Panthers. I think that the team is just too strong overall for Denver. Denver has some strong points, but Carolina is balanced on offense and defense. So I'm looking for the Panthers to win something like 27-14.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Friedel, who is covering the Super Bowl for Voice of America's Learning English. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
It was great to be here, Sonny. Thanks for having me.
Now let's go to the United Arab Emirates in the Middle East, where South African star Ernie Els has moved to the top of the leaderboard at the Omega Dubai Desert Classic Golf Tournament. The 46-year-old Els is a three-time champion in Dubai. He shot a 67 Friday and now has a total of 9 under par, 135 through two rounds. Reporter Nick Dye caught up with Ernie Els and asked him about his performance.
Yeah, it's quite nice. Yeah, surprising a little bit. You know, perfect conditions this morning. A couple of better flag positions, you know, a little tougher to get to the holes, but very pleased with that. You know, it probably won't hold up, but I'll be in the mix and thereabouts, so that's all I can ask for.
The course different of a morning as it is to the afternoon?
It's a little different. You know, the ball doesn't travel as far in the morning, but you're putting on absolutely perfect putting surfaces. And, you know, as I just said to Wayne, you know, I didn't play that well on the front nine, tee to green, but I made a lot of putts to save pars and, you know, obviously made an eagle on 18. And then played a little bit better on the back, but, you know, the front nine, as was my back nine, was a bit of a tougher nine. But I'm pleased with the way I played.
And that eagle is tasty compared to the bogey of day one. How's your ribs? How's the back? How's the result of that?
No, it's better. You know, it's getting better each day. You know, I can still feel it, but it's a lot better. And, you know, we'll keep working on it. And, you know, I can't use it as an excuse anymore. You know, it feels a lot better. And, you know, I'm looking for the weekend. You know, whatever happens, happens. But I'm playing pretty good.
Well, you've been slaving away, working hard for a considerable time. So I don't know if this is overdue or whether it's come as soon as you'd expected or what.
No, I mean, I've definitely after the first week of the year, I mean, that was probably, you know, hopefully the low point of the year because, you know, from 18 inches, I was dodgy, you know, and to make the changes that I have made, you know, drastic changes in the putting setup, the grip and so forth, and now feeling very comfortable and confident is in the about turn, isn't it? You know, because I was really nowhere, and now I feel like I've got some game. So really pleased with all the work, as you say, we've put in on and off the golf course, and you know, that's what you need to do sometimes. You know, get your feet under you and get ready for the rest of the year.
Last time you felt this good?
Yeah, it's been a while, eh? I mean, and I won the in Munich, you know, the BMW. That's a couple of years ago, and even, you know, the US Open back in that year. But the last year, I haven't felt like this. So this is, it's an about turn for me from where I was, and it's a nice feeling to have.
That South African golf star Ernie Els feeling pretty good about his performance so far at the Omega Dubai Desert Classic Tournament. And Ernie was talking Friday with reporter Nick Dye in Dubai. Just ahead on the sunny side of sports, my VOA colleague James Buddy will have a Black History Month segment on a basketball Hall of Famer and a baseball great.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month facts for today, February 5th. On this day, 1934, Henry Louis Hank Aaron was born in Mobile, Alabama. He became baseball's all-time home run hitter. Aaron entered the record books on April 8, 1974, when he broke Babe Ruth's record of 714 home run hits. He went on to hit a total of 755 home runs before completing his 23-year major league career. On this day in 1972, Robert Bob Douglas became the first African-American to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Douglas was the founder of the New York Renaissance basketball team. Nicknamed the father of black professional basketball, Douglas owned and coached the Rens from 1923 to 1949.
So now we see the light. We're gonna stand up for our rights. Yeah. So you better get up.
Don't give up the fight. Speaking of which, our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta, says the boxing world is in shock over the May 7th fight between Saul Canelo Alvarez and Amir Khan. I'll talk with Namdi about this fight next week, but one quick detail, Canelo will be defending his World Boxing Council middleweight title. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the final part of a series on South Africa's food producers. And next, a music festival held in Bamako to help restore Mali's role as a cultural powerhouse. But first some music. Here is Sayoun Kamara from Guinea with Umu.
I'm
Sayun Kamara from Guinea with Umu.
Well, a farmer in South Africa has achieved something unique. James Dyhack has crossbred two very different kinds of pigs to create a new breed. He's doing it in a way that entrenches him as part of a new wave of ethical farmers in South Africa. Darren Taylor reports in the final part of our series on some of the nation's specialist food producers.
Chickens scrabble in the dirt and pigs feud over food on Brightside Farm in the Machalies Mountains, north of Johannesburg. Farmer James Dyack says it's the most beautiful place in the world to him.
We've got 6 hectares of manicured garden, then 8 hectares of organic vegetable garden, and then meadows with sheep, cows, ducks roaming around, pigs. You know, there are no fences, so the animals go where the animals need to go. It's absolutely non-restrictive farming.
Dyack, who's also a chef, farms the land with his mother. Brightside supplies his city restaurant, Coobs, with fresh organic produce.
Particularly our pork we're very proud of, all acorn-fed, all free-range. It's our own hybrid, so what we did is we took land-raised pigs and crossed them with wild boar, so it's a 50-50 mix. It reduces the fat, increases your meat content and your flavour.
Dyack says he's an accidental pig farmer. He explains that his mother saw a very thin pig at an auction a few years ago and bought it because she felt sorry for it.
The wild boar came in later, also accidentally. Some guy imported them from Italy, and then he duly, unfortunately, passed away, and his family were like, well, we don't want these things. So I phoned my mom, and that's how we became wild boar farmers. So
Dyack says the hybrid wild boars look like commercial pigs, but fuzzy, as he puts it.
Because they're free range, they've grown a sort of a thin hair covering. They're dark. Most of them are brown with patches. They more adapt to the South African sun, which is, as we all know, is exceptionally hot, as opposed to your pink sort of Vienna looking pig.
Boars devour fallen fruit and vegetables on Brightside Farm. Dyack says his pork tastes so good because the pigs eat such extraordinary food.
We do have an oak forest on our farm, so the basis of their diet is acorns. We're very proud of the fact that we breed acorn-fed pigs, because I learned that when I was traveling in Spain.
In his busy kitchen, the chef says it's the acorns that help him produce such special meat.
And it gives this pig this sort of a lighter, less musty, boary flavor. Delicious, almost a sweetness and a nuttiness.
The boar meat is very dense and much leaner than fatty, mass-produced pork. Dyack says this is because his animals are always active outdoors, developing more muscle, and aren't fed artificial growth supplements. He adds that most large commercial pig farms, in his experience, don't show respect to the animals.
I understand that we can't all be free-range and the pigs can't skip through the fields, and that I'm well aware of. But why can't an animal grow up in a clean sty, be loaded onto truck ethically, not overpacked, forced into an abattoir and butchered, just inhumanely slaughtered and left lying there? And that's the big problem for me.
Dyack treats his boars with dignity in life and death. A mobile butcher visits his farm to slaughter the animals speedily and humanely. The meat then goes to Coob's restaurant, where customers eat Dyack's pigs from nose to tail.
We use the whole animal. So we make bacon out of the four quarters, and then we make, obviously, belly out of the belly, and then we barbecue the back leg. So we try and use everything. If someone is going to give up its life, we have the respect to use the whole animal.
Some of Dyack's patrons tuck into his slow roasted pork loin with quince and potato mash, grilled apples, and brandy butter sauce. The farmer and chef expects ethical farming and eating to become ever more popular in South Africa. He says growing numbers of his clients now prize quality of food over quantity. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A A music festival was held last week in Bamako, the capital of Mali. The goal is to restore the West African country's role as a cultural powerhouse. The festival came 3 years after Islamist extremists banned music in the region. The four-day event included singers Nawata Dumbeya and Umu Sangare and three breakthrough artists, Songhoi Blues, Demon Albaran, and Siddiqui Diabate. Katrina Hoya reports from Bamako.
4 years after the Amistad coup in the capital and jihadists occupied the country's north, Mali is beginning to reclaim its role as a regional hub for music and culture. Last year, Bamako saw the return of Le Rencontre de Bamako, a biannual photo festival that was cancelled after the 2012 crisis. More cultural events dot the horizon, including the acoustic music festival over 4 days in the capital. Toumani Diabaté is one of Mali's most acclaimed musicians, winning 2 Grammys for his work on the kora, a guitar-like instrument. He says the return of the festival means a lot to Malians.
Oui, nous, on peut dire notre groupe, c'est grâce à la crise que notre groupe a été créé.
It's not politics or politicians that move Mali and Africa forward. It's the culture and especially the music, he says. For a country like Mali that lives off and through its music and artists, it has a huge impact. The festival in Bamako takes place amid continued security concerns following the attack on the Radisson Hotel in Bamako in November last year and attack on a hotel in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, on January 15th. Diabaté says artists can help Mali heal from its wounds. Mali is known in the world for its music, says Diabaté. Artists like Ali Fakature, Salif Keita, Rokia Traore, Habib Koyate, Via Farka, Baseku Kouyaté and Balaké Sissoko has put Mali on the map, he says. This is, however, maybe only 5-10% of the musical talent in this country. We, the artists, can help Mali. It's not only the politicians. We too have an important role to play, but we lack the means. The war and conflict has made life difficult for artists and music promoters. Most foreign artists and music producers are steering clear of Mali, making it harder for artists to make connections and launch themselves in the international circuit. One exception is the band Songhoi Blues. 3 of the band's members are from towns in northern Mali. The conflict there drove them to Bamako, where the group formed at the height of the crisis in 2012. As the band's guitarist Gabriel Touré says, without the crisis, there might not have been a Songhoi Blues at all.
C'est pas la situation politique qui fait bouger l'Afrique, mais c'est surtout.
If the conflict in 2012 hadn't happened, maybe I wouldn't have been here in Bamako, where I met Aliou and Omar, with whom I formed a band, he says. The conflict was a time of terror and suffering, but for us, for the band, it proved to be a strike of luck. When British artist Damon Albarn took his transporter music project Africa Express to Bamako in 2013, he got word of a talented quartet that played the capital's bars and nightclubs. The band auditioned for Albarn and was selected for the album Africa Express, bringing together Western and Malian artists. Last year, the Songhoi Blues released its well-received debut album, Music in Exile, chronicling the conflict while offering a message of peace and reconciliation. Katrina Höye, VOA News, Bamako.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Sir Bill Workinger, and our engineer Zubair Tayeb, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the Boko Haram terrorist attacks on January 29th and 30th in northeast Nigeria. On January 30th, in the village of Dolori, the terrorist bombed a market, attacked a village, and firebombed huts. Boko Haram militants set fire to as many as 300 homes in the village, burning alive some people who were inside, including children. According to Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency, at least 65 people were killed and 136 injured. Boko Haram, which in March 2015 pledged its allegiance to the Islamic State, has been attacking northern Nigeria for years. According to press reports, Boko Haram's insurgency has killed 20,000 people in the last 6 years and driven at least 2.3 million from their homes. Boko Haram continues to commit vicious attacks against the innocent, including children. This terrorist organization repeatedly has shown no regard for human life. We extend our deepest condolences to the families of the latest victims of Boko Haram. The United States will continue to support those affected by Boko Haram's violence through ongoing humanitarian aid and support services. In response to the threat posed by Boko Haram, President Barack Obama announced in October 2015 that the United States would send 300 U.S. troops, along with surveillance drones, to Cameroon to bolster a West African effort to counter the militant Islamist group. U.S. troops were tasked with conducting airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance operations in the region. In a statement issued on February 2nd, State Department spokesperson John Kirby said the United States remains committed to supporting Nigeria and its Lake Chad Basin partners in the fight against terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.